Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Wednesday, talking some USC Trojan football with the beat writer and columnist for USCFootball.com, Dan Weber, joining the show. I want to talk about the spring quote-unquote game a little bit, but you got a lot of questions you guys have sent in, so we want to try to get to all of those and talk about all the topics that you care about. If you have any questions or want us to talk about something on the podcast, just email us, podcast@uscfootball.com, or call our new voicemail number, 424-254-9141. You can leave a voicemail there or send us a text if that's easier and check it out. We're on iTunes, itunes.com/peristylepodcast, Stitcher Radio, Audio Boom, a lot of different ways to consume the show. Leave us some positive feedback. That would be wonderful, especially on the iTunes. That's where most people end up accessing the show, and we do appreciate that. And without further ado, let's bring in Dan Weber. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Hey, pretty good. We got a lot of questions. That means maybe we won't have to talk about the spring game spring game very much, which would be a good way to go. I think it's in the rearview mirror. It was one of the less memorable practices of the 15 practices, much less a spring game. And you know, it's nice that they do the what was really nice was bringing in the new players that we haven't seen yet, sending off the seniors from last year with their Rose Bowl rings and all that. That was great stuff. I really, really liked that. But as far as the game itself, you know, I think I will enjoy some of the player-run practices more than than that spring game. And they'll be more competitive and more, you know, more interesting. So it's goodbye. And I like it in a way, because it lets you really focus on what's coming up, which is what matters.
Yeah, we got to talk to Harvey Hyde on Monday a little about the spring game, and I think that was a good recap. We don't really need to go into much more because there just wasn't much. Before we got on the show, you said it well. Like, if Sam Darnold only throws 6 passes, you know, it's really not worth talking about.
Right. I mean, he would throw 6 passes in the dummy part of scrimmage before practice.
Yeah.
You know, on a normal day. So, Sam almost had assumed the role of player coach, I think, on that day, which is a good thing, because he's going to be, for the next 2 months, he's going to be a player coach. And I think he's really looking forward, to doing that. And he talked about how he really likes it when the coaches aren't around, because there's nobody else for the young wide receiver group to listen to except him. He said, you know, when the coaches are around, they kind of have to listen to the coaches too. But when I'm out there with them, especially, you know, in the player run practices, he's going to run the practice. And that's pretty cool when you know, the kid's going into his red shirt sophomore year, but he doesn't seem like he's still technically a red shirt freshman. Doesn't seem like one.
No, certainly not. Okay, well, so this show is going to be about answering all the questions. There are a lot of different topics, kind of potpourri, if you will. So it's all over the place. So I'll just jump right in. First one says, hello, Dan. A lot of O's in his hello. last year, USC ended up 5th in the Pac-12 in scoring defense, allowing 24.2 points per game. Washington was first, allowing 17.7 points per game. Do you believe USC will improve in this category this year? And do you think they can drop below the magic number of 20 points per game? Thanks, Paul, in Santa Clarita.
Paul, that's a good point. I think absolutely. I mean, I've been really trying to push the idea that this is going to be a defense-centric, you know, defense-first team. And, you know, as much as, you know, Sam Darnold moves the needle in the Heisman, you know, expectations and the young wide receivers and a, you know, really good tight end group and we'll see how the, you know, the offensive line ends up with a lot of veterans, you know, could fill in. And if they're all healthy, and Rojo and Aka Cedric and Stephen Carr coming in and Vavae Malapai and all these names that we know on offense. I just think this is going to be a team that's going to start with defense, and defense is what shows up every week. And that's what didn't happen last week or last year. The defense was there sometimes. I mean, even in the Rose Bowl, there were some quarters, like the first and the fourth, where the defense showed up, and the second and third, they weren't in the stadium anywhere. And so I think what you have to see this year with increased depth, even if positions where, like outside linebacker, there are just four guys for the two spots, and so just the two deep, they're really good four guys. The inside linebacker could be the same way. You know, you may just have four, but it looks like there's some real, you know, real talent there. So what you're going to see, I think, is more than just the first team on the field. You're going to see, you know, two rotations. You're going to see Oluwole Batiko having a chance to, you know, as a backup, still having a chance to show what he can do in the pass rush and running people down and all that. So, yeah, I think 20 points is a really good, you know, a good number to, you know, set as a goal and to get below that. And, you know, I think I'll be disappointed if they're not. I'll be disappointed if they don't lead the Pac-12 in scoring defense. I think we should expect them to, the way the roster's shaping up and the way they've looked this spring and the way Clancy coaches them up. I think, you know, they've got the personnel to match what they're trying to do on defense. So I agree with you. Good question.
All right. Let's move on to Stephen Poway. He said, I believe it's a truism that you can replace talent, but you can't replace experience. So while I was delighted for the seniors and the early leaving juniors who received their Rose Bowl rings on the Coliseum field on Saturday, I couldn't help but wonder whether USC is going to really struggle to replace those players this year. How do you replace Adoree Jackson, Juju Smith-Schuster, even the three offensive linemen or Stevie T? As if to prove my point, I thought the play on the field seemed sloppy at times, particularly among the wide receivers who struggle to make catches. Am I just worrying for naught? Or do you think we could be in for a bit of a struggle, especially in the first few games? Thanks for all of your great work. Fight on, Steve in Poway.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a consideration. I wouldn't say it's a worry. I mean, you've got to, you know, new young talent replaces old talent. I mean, this is what college football is all about. You bring in the new guys, and you know, it's your job to get them ready to, you know, to play. And that's what has to happen here in the, you know, the 29 fall practices and the, you know, 5 or 6 weeks of player run practices. They have to get to that point. I think they know where they have to get. I don't think it would be reasonable to base any decision about where they are based on the spring game. I mean, I know that's maybe not, you know, not a fair way to do it for people who only get to see them in that game. But you know, I would not use the word worry. I would not even use the spring game as any kind of a judgment about these guys. I mean, I don't think the wide receivers, I don't think there's any drop off at all, to be honest with you. I really don't. I mean, in terms of actual performance, I mean, Deontay Burnett wasn't there. You didn't have Sam throwing, you know, to Michael Pittman and Tyler Vaughns. I would not use the word worry. I do think, you know, you got to play into experience. Experience comes with playing. But I think this is an unusual group. Not a great deal of experience as redshirts, and going against those guys who left. And they went against them, you know, hard and every day. And I thought they did a good job with the ones against the twos or mixing in the red shirts with the twos last year. So they will come out. They are coming out of last fall with more experience and a much closer to being able to, you know, to answer the bell as experienced guys. Do you replace Adoree? You know, no, of course not. You know, defensively, I think they've got a shot. In terms of that guy who's just spectacular with the ball in his hand, you know, no, they're not going to do that. But you know, if you can, you know, if you can, you know, split it up and figure out different ways to get some things done. You know, it wouldn't be something I would say, oh, woe is me. We're not going to be able to do this or we're not going to be able to do that. So that's just my take. I don't have that same sense of worry about the young guys replacing the older guys.
All right. Steve had another question. He said, watching Jack Sears play quarterback at the Coliseum on Saturday, I kept thinking it was Sam Darnold until I looked closely at the jersey number. He looked pretty good in my opinion. Do you see much of a gap between Sears and Matt Fink?
I think the gap that there is from Matt Fink improving so much and taking advantage of everything that's happened. I mean, he got a great chance to, you know, with the scout team. And, I think he's done a great job in the weight room, and he always had some natural ability to just take off with the football. And he's shown, you know, real, you know, ability to do that, but he's gotten stronger and on top of the football, delivering both the short routes and the deep routes with, much more certainty. So, I think with Jack, you know, to ask a kid who should still be in high school to step in and play at the level, you know, you're asking somebody to do at USC is just, you know, the very fact that he can do that at all tells you how much ability is there. But that year that Matt Fink has had, playing college football is a big, big, big difference. I mean, even Sam Darnold, and maybe we look back now and say, gee, maybe it shouldn't have gone that way. As good as he was, as big and strong and athletic and competitive and cool and all confident as he was, coming out of his, you know, his, I guess he just didn't get here till the summer, but you know, that freshman year, that first year, that redshirt year, he was awfully good, and still he probably needed that year. I don't know if it would have been completely fair to throw him in there, you know, with those guys. So I don't think you should expect Jack Sears as much, you know, talent, as much athletic ability, as he has to be right there with Matt Fink because of Matt Fink's, ability to take advantage of his first year. So, but you can certainly see, you know, the talent that Jack Sears has. It's kind of nice to have him rather than have two guys that are equal. It might be nice to just have, you know, one a little ahead of the other, and that's who you're chasing, because it tells you that Matt Fink has also, you know, come a long way in his first year, and I think Jack will do the same thing. Is Jack maybe a little more athletic? Maybe. I mean, I thought coming out of high school and watching his high school film and all that, he was unbelievably athletic. But Matt Fink has shown everybody something about his own athleticism. So that's an interesting you know, head-to-head with those two guys.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's certainly a gap. I thought there might not be when he came in, but I agree. I think Matt Fink's played better. Jack Sears, there's just going to be some growing pains. So yeah, I think it's pretty clear 2 and 3 right now. And you know, that'll probably change down the road, but for now, I think it's there. Tarek had a question, Dan. He said, is Jamel Cook mostly working in the nickel spot, or do you expect to see him compete for time at safety, especially with the return of Jonathan Lockett?
You know what? They finally put him in. I was thinking about this the other day, and they actually did it. They just threw him in a corner also when they kind of ran out of corners in the spring game. I don't think there's anywhere he can't play. I mean, he's got hips. He does things no 6'4" guy should be able to do. And his starts and stops, his body control. I wouldn't try to pencil him in anywhere at this point in time. I think, you know, they're going to, you know, see where he is in the playbook, where he is in terms of, you know, I mean, I think the thing that this secondary has to do this year is absolute perfection, no breakdowns in coverage, no blown play, you know, no give up, easy give ups, because if this team doesn't give up something easy, they're not going to give up anything. I mean, I think they have the athletes to just contest you on almost every time you throw the ball against them, if they're in the right place, if they're in the right coverage, if they know who's doing what. So, I mean, it's adding a layer of complexity with Jamel, who didn't get to play last year and basically, you know, showed what he could do. He went against, you know, Juju almost every day and got a chance to do those kinds of things. But now you're in another, you know, another spot. So we'll see how does he do in the player run practices and how does he pick it up. But I'd almost be comfortable with him as a 6'4" corner. I mean, he just I'm a big fan of his skill set. I just think in his attitude, in terms of how he wants to, his aggressiveness, how he wants to play the game, how he wants to understand what they need him to do is the question that he's going to have to answer in terms of his preparation and keeping his head in the game at all times and all that. But I would just see what happens, see where they end up with him. And you're right, Jonathan Lockett's return may change the calculus of the secondary, and we'll just have to see, how that all plays out.
Let's go to Eric. He said, is Rojo working on his pass-catching skills? Is he staying after practice with the wide receivers on the jugs machine? Being able to utilize him on screens and wheel routes would be a real game-changer. Thanks, as always, Eric in Duck Country.
Well, I think it's during practice, too. I mean, I think just the level of detail with DeLand McCullough as the new coach. And I know that was something Tommy Robinson always talked about, and you never know when it's going to kick in terms of Rojo's total understanding that not only does his future with USC and USC's future depend on his ability to do this, but so does his, NFL future. With the ability to really catch the football. So there's a lot of work being done there. I think it'll also be motivated by the fact that, in the spring, Vavai Malapai became a big target, for this offense. He really got a lot of chances and made a lot of plays. And Stephen Carr, they're already, talking about how that's one of the things that Stephen Carr brings to the table is the ability to throw the ball to him. So I think what you're going to see is just, the competition, within the team is going to inspire, I think, Rojo. I mean, Rojo is definitely more detailed oriented about everything he does. The other thing that they obviously are working on is pass protection. You don't want to have to always take him out. You want him to be, and he wants to be an every down back. He's 205 now. He certainly looks like he hasn't lost anything. He might be quicker, but you want a kid like that on the field at all times. But you need him to be able to block, pass block, and you need him to be able to be that outlet receiver. And so they're working on it. They're thinking about it, and we'll see. Unfortunately, he had the turf toe in the spring, so we didn't get to see as much of that as we'd like to see. Again, one more item on the agenda to make it happen during the player run practices before they get into fall practice and those 29 practices. But that's certainly on the to-do list for Rojo.
Let's see. Let's go to Paul in Vegas. He said, I've waited until after spring ball to bring up this question. It has to do with the scholarships for the minor sports. Do we offer fewer scholarships than other major programs in sports like baseball, swimming, etc.? I realize the cost of athletic scholarships at a school like USC are tremendously expensive. Does this limitation prevent us from putting championship teams on the field or in the water? For us to win national championships in water polo, do we offer more scholarships? Stanford always does so well in both men's and women's minor sports. Do they offer more athletic scholarships in those sports than we do? Thanks, Paul in Vegas.
Good questions, Paul. I think the scholarship limitation, USC gives whatever the allowed scholarships are, USC gives them. I think it impacts you gravely in baseball, for example. 11.5 scholarships when you need about 30 players to have a really big-time program. And USC doesn't have the ability, with a tuition of $65,000 or whatever, to have the kind of walk-ons. You can split scholarships up, but, a kid gets a partial scholarship at USC, still is responsible for a whole lot more money than he would be should he choose to go to UC Irvine or Long Beach State or Riverside or UCLA and Cal State Fullerton, for example. And you can win a national championship. Well, at least at three of those others, you can probably win a national championship. Four, maybe. Win a national championship in baseball, certainly as easily as you could at USC. You know, that wasn't the case back in the 50s and 60s when Rod Dedeaux's teams just dominated, not just on the West Coast, but nationally. It's very, very difficult to do it. A program like Stanford basically is full scholarship for every kid whose family income is under $100,000. And since Stanford does that, it's kind of like an Ivy League school. There's no advantage for baseball players, let's say, going to Stanford or whatever. If you get admitted and your family income is under $100,000, you know, you're on scholarship. And because those are not geared to athletics, it's just every single kid in school gets that kind of student aid. It gives a Stanford an advantage in a sport like baseball. I think sports where there are so many events and you need so many participants to score points, like track and field and swimming, let's say. That's where USC runs out of bodies. You know, you could have, you know, really, really good, you know, like when they had Andre DeGrasse a couple of years ago, was the best sprinter in the country by far, and had a number of people, you know, in the sprints, let's say, or the jumps or the, field events. You still run out of bodies when it comes to all those, you know, let's say relay races and things like that, or distant events, that they just, USC, I don't think he has the numbers to be able to compete. That's why USC will finish way higher than, say, UCLA in the national meets, because they have people who can win and score points. But when they go head-to-head in a USC-UCLA event, UCLA just has so many more athletes that they often have a chance to beat USC with a clearly inferior team at the top level. So yeah. The scholarship limitations in some of the sports. And I don't know, I wish I knew water polo better. It just looks like that sport, like tennis and golf, doesn't seem to be limited as much by the numbers. The numbers of scholarships that you're allowed do not limit you the way they do, say, in baseball. And that's about the best way I can give you an answer. It's a good question. It's a real factor. I think baseball's the worst one to only allow 11 and a half scholarships when you need 30 players. That's a really difficult situation for USC. I mean, USC's got the best baseball tradition in NCAA history. And yet, I think, you know, when they legislated some of these things, I think the people who passed these scholarship limitations, and you know, it's in reaction to somewhat to Title IX, but didn't mind limiting those numbers, because, you know, at a lot of the state schools and the big schools, it's so much easier to walk on. And when they split scholarships, it's so much easier to make up the difference in a, you know, state school tuition. So it's a tough deal. You know, some schools have figured out how to do it. I think Stanford, for a while, they've kind of gone away. Vanderbilt and Rice still have maintained that ability, but they are not competing in metropolitan areas and markets where the kids have a whole lot of other choices if they want to be on a really great program. If you're in, you know, Central Tennessee, or if you're in Texas, or in the Houston area, there's not much competition right there, whereas in LA you've got these other five or six programs that are just so good that it's just too easy for kids to say, I'd rather go there and it'll cost me about a fourth as much as if I go to USC. So good question.
Earl in West LA said, I was trying to take the high road in my comment last week, by overlooking Larry Scott's despicable decision to exclude USC from the inaugural Pac-12 championship game. During the 5 years of bowl bans and scholarship limitations, USC appeared on national television more than any other school in the conference, driving television revenue to the other member schools who, along with Scott, never defended USC against the sanctions. USC appears to have a lot of financial clout, yet they seem reluctant to use it. What do you think would have to happen for USC to finally exert its financial clout? Earl in West L.A.
Dan Earl, I wish I knew. I don't know. Will the fact that between now and the time the Pac-12 TV contract is up in 2024, the fact that Rutgers or Illinois will bring in $200 million more from the Big Ten TV program than than USC will get from the Pac-12 program? I mean, even for USC, having raised $6 billion in the last 6 years, $200 million is like real money. And maybe USC will finally realize we got to do something if we want to be competitive with, you know, Ohio State's going to also get that $200 million. On top of everything else the Ohio State program generates, which I guess is probably the second wealthiest to Texas in the country. And yet, when USC plays Texas, when USC plays Ohio State, people aren't going to say, oh, gosh, USC shouldn't be able to compete with these guys. They've got way more money and way more facilities and way more. No, people are going to expect USC to, I mean, you think people aren't going to expect USC to beat Texas this year? And, this, you know, it's a Texas program that had just put in every locker for the new, in their new football locker room, every player, instead of a nameplate, has a 42-inch flat-screen TV. I guess they got his name on it, too. But they just decided, yeah, let's give them all 42-inch flat-screen TVs at the top of their locker room, or their locker, their individual lockers. I mean, that's the kind of money these schools, and I'm not saying USC should do that. I just think it's ridiculous. But USC's being asked to compete at that level, and not being, you know, and doesn't have exactly the same opportunity to do so. Now, if you, you know, add in where all those programs are adding seats and averaging more than 100 million or 100,000 a game in football, USC's trying to drop the Coliseum down to 77.5. I mean, it's like, what are they thinking? So will something hit them in the head hard enough to make the people, you know, at USC realize, you know, this may be going in the wrong direction, but the thought that, you know, an average, really below average program in the Big Ten will generate $200 million between now and 2024 than USC is going to get from the Pac-12 TV contract might make people at USC think, you know what, we may be in the wrong place, and we may be, you know, locked in with the wrong teams. And you know, it might even ask themselves, you know, should Oregon State and Washington State be getting exactly as much money every year from the Pac-12 TV arrangements as USC? I don't know. So, Earl, keep asking that question and ask it, you know, ask it of as many people as you can. We will. We don't get any answers, but I think we just have to keep asking.
Yeah, definitely worth asking. Let's see. Kevin, he said, curious to know if the school, he's talking about USC, have petitioned for additional eligibility for Kenny Bigelow and Tua Lobodon. Both were injured for the season pretty early last year. Do you think Kenny, don't think Kenny even suited up for a game, and Tua went down in the first half of the first game. Doesn't that usually constitute a good case for one more year? Thanks, Kevin, no longer in South Orange County.
Hey, Kevin. Well, I think two things. One, I don't think you can. The NCAA's cleverly made it so you can't do that. You have to finish what would have been your last year. Then you can petition them. Then, of course, they can do what they did to Jordan Simmons and say, nah, never mind, go away, you're finished. So as much as you would think, okay, that may qualify, it may or may not. My understanding is, though, they can't do that until you've finished your 5 years of eligibility. Then you can ask for the 6 year. And since neither one of them has completed that, they wouldn't be able to ask for it, I think, until next January.
All right. Thanks for that one. We got Stephen Poway said, when the incoming freshmen were introduced at the final spring practice, he didn't call it spring game, I was shocked to see how big Brandon Peely looked in person, particularly when standing next to the other incoming players. My first thought was, wow, he looks more like an offensive lineman than a defensive lineman. I noticed the USCFootball.com recruiting page has him listed as 6'4", 300 pounds, but I would say he looked more like a Damian Mama, quote-unquote, 300 pounds, than a Leonard Williams, quote-unquote, 300 pounds. Have you heard anyone within the program talking about him starting him out on the offensive side of the ball, especially with some of the recent depth issues there? Thanks, Stephen Poway. And he said, P.S., big shout-out to the two nice USC fans I sat next to at the practice who offered me a seat when I couldn't find my original spot. The Trojan family is for real. Well, that was nice, Stephen.
Yeah, Stephen, your observation was that of everybody we were standing next to, especially when we got down on the field. He's a big kid. Whether that translates to going over to offense or not, I don't know. Yeah, see, he hasn't had a great deal of luck with those back and forth transfers for some reason. Maybe coaching, all the disruption in terms of year to year to year on the offensive line. I don't know how I think about that in terms of, I'm just happy to have somebody that big and looking as athletic as it seems he is, and let it sort itself out this first year that he's here. But you're right, you could not miss that. And that's one of the things, even for the players that are already in the program, listed weights. I mean, I probably drive them crazy because almost every time I talk to the USC kids, I ask them, what do you weigh today? And those kids, usually they're supposed to weigh themselves pretty much every day. And those weights can be off, 15 or 20 pounds, one way or the other. I mean, I think they still have Vavai listed at 190. There's just no possible way he's still just 190. But Rojo is listed 195. He's 205. Guys just, I think with Chad Wheeler, we were trying to keep track of last year. I think his weight, the day I asked him last year in fall practice, his weight was 37 pounds different from what he was listed on the roster. So then you're talking high school kids. It's really hard. I mean, they're often in a growth spurt, or they're often really, hitting the weights in a serious way that they haven't done, before that. And so, trying to match up the listed weight with the actual weight is almost a fool's errand anymore. You just have to look at him and say, okay, this is what I think he weighs, as much as looking at any of the listed weights, because they're not all that worthwhile in terms of accuracy.
Let's see. We got we've got a couple more. We'll let you go. Reggie in Seattle said, my comment today is regarding all of the injuries. I'm not referring to the ACLs or major things like that, just little things that keep athletes from practicing. I've noticed the USC guys seem to always be banged up. Perhaps it's the nature of the beast. But what if anything can be done by the USC training staff to negate some of these little injuries? And secondly, is there an issue or concern that should be directed towards the trainers, or is this a player issue? Fight on, Reggie in Seattle.
They're really all different kinds of injuries. I think some of it is from the fact they really went hard and they really hit. I mean, they didn't, it wasn't like 2 hours, full tackle, but when they hit, they hit. This is a team that looks like they really enjoy going out there and hitting people. and they competed. I mean, I think it doesn't surprise me maybe that Rojo ended up with Turco. He made some cuts this spring that, and you know, he's a 205 pounder, and that may be, you know, kind of a difference. I just think they worked them, you know, really hard, and I think they're being very smart and safe. I think had they had a game to play last week, it wouldn't have surprised me if most of those kids would have played. I think, for example, Toe is very close, but they said nope, we'll clear him right when they finish spring, and they didn't feel the necessity. Oh, we got to get him in there. Or Daniel Amater, baby, he's out there every day with a yellow shirt on for part of practice. They're just playing it safe, but they're getting them in there. So I think it's more overblown than it seems to us when we see him out there. I would not go to a place where you have a feeling, oh, you know, we've got more injuries than they've got or whatever. I just don't think that's something that I would say about USC. If I were a USC fan, I wouldn't say, oh, what the heck's wrong with our trainers or whatever. I think they do a pretty good job, and I think some of that is just to some extent luck of the draw, and it happens. And I know people say, well, what about Stanford? They put out this video and they don't get anybody injured. And then you say, well, wait a minute, Christian McCaffrey, how much of the year did have a sort of a mystery kind of a deal that nobody seems to know what exactly it was, and then he didn't play in the bowl game? So, you know, I think your own perspective sometimes makes you focus on your team, and maybe you don't see, you know, what everybody else is doing. I mean, look across town, poor UCLA and the injuries they had, starting with, you know, Josh Rosen, and that was just a season-killing, you know, injury that nobody was completely certain exactly what was going on there and all that. So this spring I wouldn't use that as a, you know, a rationale to say, hey, what's going on here with the USC training staff or the players or whatever. I think they were being careful by the end and looking at, you know, down the road and not needing. I mean, they brought Kenny Bigelow pretty far back, but they said, you know, we don't need to actually play him full go 11 on 11, but we can get him in there and get him in, you know, into contact and all that. So I think they pushed it pretty far. They just didn't take any chances. I kind of like that.
One last one for you, Dan. We'll let you go. Chris wrote in and said, with all of the modern equipment, concussion protocols, and overall health and nutrition oversight, do you think it's time the NCAA allows spring camp to extend to the end of April just before academic finals approach and allow more authorized full-on tackling practices? Because of the over-governing from the NCAA, in my humble opinion, the core requirement physicality of the game is being threatened. To borrow from the new Texas football head coach, during his first post-spring camp press practice conference, Coach Tom Herman mentions, I'm still not sure why we don't allow them to put their safety equipment on. He was referring to the limited authorization of full pads and tackling practices. Ryan, Dan, your thoughts are greatly appreciated. Fight on from Chris.
Well, I think there will be necessary changes in the physicality. I'm a big fan of the rugby style tackling that the, you know, Seahawks have pushed pretty far, where you get your head out of the way. And I mean, those guys, if you ever watch those rugby matches, you know, up close, and there are a lot of big guys running into a lot of people, and they got these little ear pad kind of helmets on, and that's about it. And I think football has to go that way. I think they've got to take the helmet out of that direct, you know, drill, when you drill somebody directly with your helmet, whether you drill them helmet to helmet or wherever you put it. I would like to see football. And so if you could spend more time doing that, I think that'd be great. I think we're going to see it transition, or football might be in some danger if if there are enough of these, you know, enough head injuries, enough, you know, direct helmet, top of the helmet contacts, that just shouldn't happen. And so I'd like to see them encourage people to feel very comfortable doing that. I think it's a better way to tackle, period. I think it's a safer, tackle in terms of more secure, more likely to make the tackle, less chance to miss, as well as it's safer for the player, you know, making the tackle. I do agree there could be some unintended consequences when you limit the amount of time in, you know, in safety gear, because we see them in the player run practices and they don't have helmets on. And I know, you know, in spring ball, even without, when they come out without pads, they require them to have their helmets on. So, you know, that might be an issue when somebody ought to say, wait, why couldn't they wear their helmets in the, you know, the player run practices? But I know they get a little nervous because it's that getting it closer to an actual practice as opposed to a player run practice. Because, you know, they want them, you know, they don't want the managers out there full scale and all the equipment out there and all that, because they know how quickly that would become a real practice, even if the coaches weren't there. So it's a fine line they got to walk. But anything that I think they could do, to allow guys A, to be more safe, and B, to work on things like, you know, a safer, more secure way of tackling, I'm all for.
All right, Dan Weber, USCFootball.com, beat writer and columnist. Great stuff, as always. We had a wide range of questions, and I'm glad everyone got to send those in, and glad you got to address them all. So I hope you had a good time. It was fun.
Yeah, great job by all. You know, people are thinking the big thoughts now. I think I like that. You know, we're the future, and not just future for USC, but, you know, the future for college football and future for the Pac-12, and there's a lot of future things to think about right now, and this is a good time to do it.
It certainly is. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. You can check us out on our website, peristylepodcast.com, and, of course, uscfootball.com. For Dan Weber, this is Ryan Abraham. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by uscfootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.